we were happy people. Neighbors knew neighbors, grandparents, families lived close together, were able to walk here, walk there, do what we wanted to do without bothering anybody.
Hello and welcome. My name is Britt Fuller, and you're listening to Beyond the Dollar, a podcast brought to you by the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. In this episode, we explore the past, present, and future of gentrification in Durham, North Carolina. I was fortunate enough to sit down with local community members Monique Holsey-Hyman, Reginald Johnson, Constance Wright, and Nate Baker to understand how this issue is a clear product of racial oppression through capitalistic exploitation. We begin our conversation in the 1960s. At this point, Durham's black community was thriving. The Hittite district south of downtown was internationally recognized as a pillar of resiliency and growth following the quote-unquote end of the Jim Crow era. Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois famously dubbed the area Black Wall Street due to the local commerce and quality of life. Considering that these two African-American leaders rarely agreed on anything, the designation speaks to the prowess of the town. Constance Wright, a lifelong resident and repeated victim of gentrification, finally remembers the Hittite area from her childhood.
Hittite was booming. We had a theater, the Rigger Theater. We had a hotel. We had a pharmacy. We had restaurants. We had nightclubs. We had everything. And that was what we needed.
But downtown Hittite was more than this. Not only was the area an economic hub, it also served as a social focal point in the community.
Downtown Durham, when I was young, was our meeting place on Saturdays. The teenagers would go down there, we'd go shopping. Friday nights was our meeting place, my brother and I, to meet my mom down there to have dinner. We would go to Cress's or wherever, but we would have dinner down there. And then on Saturdays, you would just see people from all over Durham, downtown, going to the different stores, going to grocery shopping, doing all the things that they needed to do.
Citizens were excited and ambitious because, for a brief moment, it felt like racial status would no longer suppress communal growth.
That was what we needed. But somebody saw opportunity to destroy.
Black communities were clearly doing well, but despite celebrating their positive trajectory and building off of it, the white-controlled government laid out a long-term blueprint for urban planning that would disrupt Durham's housing landscape for the benefit of the white folk. The period begins with destabilizing the economic force of inner-city communities by attracting business to the suburbs.
All of a sudden, they built the malls, which pulled the businesses, you know, people from downtown into the outskirts of Durham, going to the malls and everything.
Life began to slow down in the city. With less of an economy, there was also less money to go around. Most white families followed the businesses out towards the suburbs. This period was called the White Flight. Many black communities stayed in the area to preserve historical roots, as they were promised assistance by the government. Reginald Johnson, Durham's Director of Community Development, discusses the impact of the disingenuous claims of support by the white government.
A lot of the businesses were made promises that were not kept. Some went out of business. The same happened with residential populations. In economic terms, it's disinvestment, where investment has not been going into the community on the south side of the freeway or being withheld. And so then you begin to exacerbate a division that was already in existence.
In my area, they built this place called Tin City, which was supposed to be a temporary housing of the businesses that were in Hittite. We were promised that they were going to build the businesses back. They were going to build houses for us and all of this. You know, we're thinking, okay, they're going to do something good for us, but they did, which made the homes go down, value of the properties go down. They never touched that area again. The purpose of all of that was to do just what you see now.
A decade of decay ensued. Incomes decreased, infrastructure depreciated, and predominantly black communities suffered from economic stagnation. The intentional sleepy period established the groundwork for affluent white populations to begin taking advantage of inner-city minority communities. Federal, state, and city governments implemented racist policies such as the Urban Renewal Act and redlining. The redlining process is an extremely important part in understanding the history of gentrification. This was a blatantly discriminatory practice where certain geographic zones were determined to be too hazardous to invest in. The people in these zones, which were predominantly black populations, could therefore not receive loans to purchase houses. The community was then forced to rent more frequently than own houses, which would later make the residents more vulnerable to price volatility. Alternatively, urban renewal was a very loose policy that came out of the National Housing Act. The federal government gave large sums of money to local governments with few strings attached. The money was to be used for slum clearance, and slums were vaguely defined. City after city across the country, the money was directed towards black communities after the destabilization period of white flight. The primary casualty in Durham was the Haight's Eye community.
When I lived in Felver Street Projects, that was the beginning of what I noticed as the urban renewal, because they literally gutted all of Haight's Eye and all of the black communities, but it impacted me because I did live in Haight's Eye. They put the ballpark on the ballot for the people to vote for, and they voted it down. But the city council went back and overrode the vote and built the ballpark anyway in the heart of the black neighborhood.
The racist and capitalistic white agenda was clear as they completely dismissed the resistance from black residents. After sustained decay, downtown Durham was sparkling with opportunity. From the oppressive white perspective, the only remaining obstacle was to remove the black communities from the city center. The plan would most specifically be executed through pricing mechanisms in the housing sector.
When I bought my house, I paid $50,000. Okay. They have come in and torn down houses or bought up houses and flipped it. And now they're charging one house on the street behind me, which is the same square footage as mine. They're charging $289,000 for that house. Two streets over, they have built two huge houses on one lot. One is right behind the other, and they're selling those for almost $400,000. The house beside me, it used to rent for like $600. Now it's $1,100.
In addition to external pressures from investors, local governments increased expenses through property taxes.
My property taxes went up from $800 to last year was $1,500. And this year is $1,600. We are being priced out of our own neighborhood. That's gentrification.
Individuals cannot keep pace with increasing prices. They are forced to act in their own self-interest and move to cheaper, albeit less desirable, locations. The dominoes begin to fall, and the process of gentrification takes place.
We talk about laws, but also we are under an economic system, capitalism, free market. And persons can are free to sell their property, you know, for the price that they can agree to sell it to someone who will purchase it for that same price. A lot of times it's African Americans who are selling their properties. They want to get a price for it and make a profit, and that's the challenge. It's just that when everybody on the block makes that same decision, which is an individual, is a rational decision. I want to sell a property and I can make X amount of money on it. But when all the blocks, everybody makes that same decision, then you have an impact. That's when you start to have gentrification.
When contemplating systemic problems, we should zoom out and contextualize the environment in which they exist. Nate Baker is a professional urban planner and Durham native. In our discussion, we focus on the forces of capitalism and how they exacerbate the issue of gentrification.
It's good to like interrogate the system again. Like, is this a glitch of capitalism, or is this like inherent to capitalism? And I think there's, you know, a lot of evidence that shows that this is inherent to capitalism. You know, housing is necessary universally. Everyone needs housing, but it is distributed based on ability to pay. And so that system, unhindered, will result inherently in people being pushed around, being pushed out. But gentrification requires multiple parts of a process. It requires disinvestment and it requires reinvestment and sort of a back and forth flow of disinvestment and reinvestment.
The pursuit of self-interest is at the heart of the capitalistic system. When paired with racist undertones and gone relatively unchecked, this individualistic, me-first mantra creates massive problems for already disenfranchised communities.
In some ways, I'm blaming big capital because they're just one-track minded. They just want to get their project through and move on. They're driven by this desire to have low risk and profitability.
Companies with deep pockets have accrued significant pull, both in the private and public sectors.
Big capital has most of the power, and that also includes the power through the state.
In other words, money talks, crap walks, okay? But yeah, but that's it. You don't even have to be in the meetings or anything to see if somebody comes in and offers a little bit more, they're going to take it, but they're going to dress it up just like with Haytide. They're going to make you feel like they're going to come in and do this A, B, C, and D for you, but then they don't even do A.
So how do we fix this? How do we create an environment where progress is encouraged, but equity is maintained?
I would say that the answer to that is allowing people the opportunity, giving people shared power and empowering people to be able to shape the world around them. And part of that means being allowed to be part of that process. People need to be able to have the time outside of work. They need to feel safe. So we need to have safe, secure neighborhoods. It needs to be sustainable. So we need to be thinking about climate change and the environment. And we need to be thinking about the economics and the finances behind it so that low-income people and long-time residents and people on fixed incomes and disabled people and young people can all be part of that and are not being pushed out because a landlord wants to kick them off their property or because of coercive practices by predatory equity or by predatory home buyers.
Lastly, I spoke with City Council member Monique Holsey-Hyman. Holsey-Hyman was recently elected to Durham's local government. With a background in social work, she brings an acute focus to affordable housing in Durham.
We're a Dillon state, so we can't really tell people what they can build, which I wish we could. So we've got investors coming in, and they don't have to actually build affordable housing. I wish I could say, this is what I need. If you're building 102 townhomes and that's approved, I need 50% of those to be affordable housing. That's what I would want in my wish list. But again, there are state legislatures that say we can't do that. I want to make a change. I'm very solution focused, right? Well, now I sit in the seat. And so what I have to do is educate the public. They may think it's an excuse, but it is truly a barrier. Because if it wasn't a barrier, you better believe, I would be like, let's get this, this is what I need. Come over here, let's talk. You know what I mean? But I don't think the public understand.
In the short term, few options present themselves as truly effective in preventing gentrification.
What we can do is try to make sure we target and have more housing for folks who are in particular income levels. From the federal side, you have legislation that has created the low-income housing tax credits that are administered by the state. But of course, that's federal authorization, that's Internal Revenue Service. But that pumps a lot of money and gives incentives for those with money to invest in affordable housing through low-income housing tax credits. Locally, the city of Durham has voted for 2 cents on the tax rate, which generates every year about between $7.5 and $8 million that we use locally. And then the voters, Durham voters have approved the $95 million affordable housing bond referendum that we use to support the Housing Authority in its creation of more affordable units as well as other developers. So we have some resources that we are using. It's not enough, but the community has been generous.
As for a longer horizon, any real change starts with a collective transformation in culture.
There's a right and a wrong way to do community engagement, but I think that a true empowerment of ordinary people is a pretty key aspect of being able to inclusively build a city.
To achieve these goals, it is necessary to create policies that economically incentivize businesses to work in favor of the public interest. Additionally, higher education and job training must be made accessible to lower-income communities. The war against gentrification may require significant restructuring of current systems, but it will undoubtedly result in progress towards equality.
It's not one magic solution. Matters are complicated. They're historical, as we alluded to earlier. You know, their policy at different levels, from the federal, state, and local, which all have different roles. It's also economic. And that's not to make excuses, but that is reality. And so we have to make sure we pull all these levers to try to get solutions.
Johnson is right. There is no clear solution to the housing crisis in Durham. And the problem only intensifies with time. Not only are people losing their homes, they're also losing their personal history.
Whenever they do implement the new comprehensive plan and the new policies, is there anything that's going to be left to salvage?